All right. I am now recording the rest of this anyway. I think you should probably assume that there will be something like one question from each of the chapters in the first half and two questions from each in the second, but it's not going to be that neat and tidy, but that's sort of the right order of magnitude estimate of how I'm going to try to do it. And as I say, that I will try, if I can, to get at things in a different way in the final than I did in the midterm. But I haven't written the final yet, and I will probably not write it except for bits and pieces of it until after the last class, because I don't really want to be in a position where when I'm summarizing things, I know which ones I'm going to ask you about, since that would just result in spending my time teaching you how to get a better score on the exam instead of how to know the material in the course, which is not useful. Anything?
No. I have one quick question. So on the last homework problem, we're just going over the step number two. You used the opposite number listed in the Z table.
You have to look at the table, but my memory is that the table shows the cumulative probability up to that value of Z.
So that's showing basically what's underneath the curve, and in this
underneath the curve up to that point.
And you were asking what's beyond it in the question. Then okay, I just want to.
It's all underneath, of course, but one of them is below your cutoff line, and the other is above.
Okay. I understand that. That makes sense.
Then, if you think conceptually what you're doing with these curves, that's the normal distribution, which we get away with using in a problem like this because the central limit theorem tells us at least roughly that as long as we've got a fair number of points in our average, it will be normal, roughly normal. And let's say that's your z value. I have to look at the table to see, but I'm pretty sure that what the table shows is that area, the area under the curve, below this, and often the question you want to ask is the area above. We know the total area under the curve is 1. Because it's a probability distribution, and if you consider all possible outcomes, their sum probably has to be 1. Something happens, right? Therefore, if this number is 0.9, if 0.92 represents that area, then 0.08 is going to represent that area.
All right. That's all. Okay. I just want to make sure. Thanks.
And you could imagine, I can't think of any experiment that would do it, but you could imagine some experiment that some hole told you z is between this and this. And you would then say, well, what's this value, what's this value, what's their difference, and that would tell you what the area was between those. I can't think of any test that would give that result, but I'm sure that with enough ingenuity one could imagine a statistical process in which did that. Other questions? Comments? Things? Particular things that you missed?
Because, I know more than you do about the contents of the course, but less than you do about the contents of your heads. That's relevant to what we ought to spend our time trying to do. All right. Works better if I do that first. So, what is decision theory? And basically, it's a way of formalizing how you make decisions. And it's not magic, and it won't make you wise. On the other hand, if you've ever been in the kind of tangle, you say, well, should I do this? But if I do this, that'll happen. But maybe I should do this and that, and so forth. It helps get you out of the tangle, saying, all right, take a damn piece of paper, take a pen, and start diagramming this thing. And with luck, the set of choices you're making become clearer when you do that. So that you simply conceptualize what you're doing as, I am making choices, things are happening, choices sometimes have costs, and the final result of my choices and things happening is some outcome which has some value or cost to me. Right, that's conceptually. So I'm saying, I make a choice, something happens, you make another choice. And somebody before class started, somebody was commenting that he had problems with the decision theory problem on the midterm because it wasn't clear to him that the first choice was do you or do you not spend money on investigating to see whether there's evidence in the email that's going to help the other side. And my basic response is, well, you knew that you could spend money doing that. If you're going to do it, when are you going to do it? Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense to first accept their settlement offer and then go and see whether they've got any evidence. And it makes much more sense to say, well, if I'm going to do it at all, I'm going to do it before I decide whether to go to settle or go to trial. And so what does that mean? It means that your first decision is, do I spend the money to search those emails to find out whether somebody in my firm said something that's going to look embarrassing at that trial? All right? Well, if that's your first decision, what's the next thing that's going to happen?
You're going to find out
if the decision you make, depending on the decision, if the decision you make is to search it, you then have a random event. All right? Random from your standpoint, obviously. Not random from the standpoint of the world. It's going to happen or not happen. But,
so what's going on? You have a choice, and your choice is to search or don't. And if you search, you then have a branch which says, what do you find? All right? And this, let us say, is good news. Your employees kept their mouths shut, at least as far as email is concerned. And this is bad news. And then that's going to face you with another choice. All right? Something happened. Boom. And at this point, what are your... If you... With good news or bad news, at this point, what's the choice you got to make?
Settle or go to
trial, right? This one, we never didn't search, so we aren't going to have that random event. So this one, you just get another choice, settle or go to trial. Right? Once you decide that, if you settle, it's all over. Decide how much money you have to pay for the settlement. Figure out what the net effect of that is. If you go to trial, then there's another sequence of events. And that you can diagram that in a number of ways according to how you think about the probability of the bad news being there. In this case, you don't know if it's there or not, so you could work out, if you look at the numbers, you could say, what's the probability they're going to win? It's the probability there's some bad news there times the probability that there is their bad news, they will prevail. Because in the case is assumed, if there was no bad news, you were guaranteed to win. So you have a probability for their winning, a probability for their losing. Payoffs reach, there are probabilities here. Each of these has a probability. These don't have probabilities because these are your choices, not a roll of the die. All right? So you then, up here, with good news, in this particular case, you could either settle, but that would be stupid. But the good news, you go to trial, which you know you're going to win. And with the bad news, in the problem that's set up, you could settle or go to trial, and you look at the outcomes, and you obviously want to settle. And you then run it back, and you say at each stage, all right, since in this one with bad news, I could go to trial, or I could settle. And you look at the outcomes in each case, and you say, you say, I don't want to go to trial with bad news. Mistake. With good news, you would settle or go to trial. On that one, you lop off the other branch, because on that one, you know that you would want to go to trial. And you then say, well, all right, since if this happens, I'm going to settle. This probability times the result of my settling is the cost of what happens here. This probability times the cost of trial is what happens there. Sum those, and we say, after I search, what's my average payoff? I don't search, what's my average payoff? Compare those and decide who your highest payoff. All right? So it's really a sort of a very simple mechanical way of drawing out the process that everybody goes through anyway of here are the uncertainties, here are the choices I'm making, this is the sequence of events, and so forth. All right? And one possible complication has to do with how do you judge outcomes. And the easy way to judge outcomes is the way sort of mathematicians doing theory of gambling tend to do it, which is you just say you sum up probability times payoff. That coin flip, $10 heads, nothing tails, that's worth $5. And if you flip coins enough, it is worth $5. Flip coins out enough, central limit theorem tells us it's going to average out. But on the other hand, if it's a coin flip,
heads I get $1 million, tails I get nothing, a lot of people would say, sorry, I'd much rather have $500,000 for certainty. So in those cases where the uncertainty is big enough so that risk aversion matters for your, for the person to whom the money is going to, which is usually your client, you then have to think through the question of how much does your client vary the different value, the different outcomes. How does your client feel about outcome A versus outcome B in deciding what you want? It might be that the settle one is one where your client receives $100,000 with certainty. The trial, you say your odds are you're going to end up with $300,000. How big are the odds? 55%, 300,000, 45%. We lose 50,000 because we've got to spend the money on the cost of the trial. Your client might say, yes, on average, I'd be winning money, but I don't want to do that. I want the safe one. That you'll have to find out by talking to your client. That in order to draw your diagram, there are a bunch of pieces of information you need, and decision theory won't give them to you. What decision theory does do is to give you a shopping list, to tell you, all right, in order to rationally make these decisions, this is what you'd have to know. And you say, all right, well, let's see. I'd have to have an estimate of the probability of prevailing under these circumstances. How do I get that? Well, I talk to the senior partner who's tried 17 cases like this and ask him what he thinks the odds are. Or I get our newest employee, who's a summer hire, who's just finished his 2L at Santa Clara, and I say, go through the county records, find every case that looks like this, and see what happened to them. You could imagine other possible ways. But basically, decision theory isn't telling you that. All decision theory is telling you is one of the things you need is an estimate of the odds. Similarly, one of the things you need is an estimate of, if we prevail, how much money are they going to award? And again, it's then up to you as a lawyer who knows stuff to find some way of finding that estimate, whether that's asking someone else or doing research or whatever. And some of the information is going to be from your client, that your client almost certainly knows some features of the situation much better than you do, and therefore you ought to talk to him. So any questions on that? That's decision theory, and I'm not going to go through more at the moment, but you should know. Now, game theory, unlike decision theory, is a sort of thing you could easily spend a semester on. We've just sort of touched the surface of it. And game theory is about strategic behavior. It's about interactions with several people where each of them, as it were, is trying to game the other, where each of them is saying, how is my action going to behave to depend on your action? How is your action going to depend on my action? How do I best get whatever I'm trying to get given those relationships? And as I say, that becomes a very hard problem to think about. And you can look at it as given a game, given that somebody says, here are the rules, paper, scissors, rock, tantrum game, driving on the right side versus left side of the road game, any game you can imagine. Given that game, one question would be, if you're playing it, how ought you to play? A different question would be, given that game, what will in fact happen? Because you might not be one of the players. You might be the person designing the game, or you might be the person who is trying to figure out something depending on the outcome of that game. Right? If the game is driving right side, driving left side of the road, and you're in the auto repair business, you'd like to know whether the outcome is going to be everybody drives on the same side of the road and you're out of business, or whether the outcome is going to be a whole lot of debted cars coming in to keep you rich. All right? So one perspective is the perspective of the player figuring out how to play, and the other is that of somebody who's analyzing the result. And they're connected, because how do you analyze the result? You say, well, if the player plays in this way, which we figured out is how he ought to play, how he best achieves his objectives, and that player, what's going to come out of all of their actions? So if you're writing a contract, once the contract is written, you're going to be one of the players. But what you're doing in designing the contract is saying, given that each of the people affected by this contract is acting for his own interest, what's going to happen? How can I write the contract to make what comes out of that game as attractive to me as possible? And that's a lot about what the chapter on contracting was about. And ditto for a legislator or somebody designing his business or anything else. And we looked at a number of different ways you could represent a game, try to sort of like the decision theory, try to formally somehow lay it out in a way that'll let you understand it. And one very simple way is a decision tree, and that's just like decision theory, except there's more than one player. So decision tree, by a sequential game, I mean a game where what's happening is I make a move, you observe my move. You make a move, I observe your move, and so forth and so on. And it's not true of all games. There are games where I don't observe your move until much later. If I don't know if any of you have played, there used to be a class of board games where you had these little pieces which had symbols on them saying how powerful they were, and they were facing you. Do you ever play those?
Stratego.
Stratego was probably the best known of those games. Yeah. When I was a college student, I ended up spending a week visiting a very weird family. I may have mentioned before, the Myers, who first homeschooled kids I ever knew. And at the time I visited them, the older brother was the under 21 chess champion of the U.S., the younger brother the under 14 chess champion of the U.S., and the first time I played one of those games, I knew it was just a waste of time, because it didn't matter which side of the block they were looking at. Once a piece had ever been revealed, it was, you know, it could have been painted on the other side to them. I mean, these were the kind of people who could play chess in their head, you know, remember a game they played a month ago and so forth. So that was sort of a humbling experience, running into a 13-year-old who could, with no trouble at all, outplay me at games like this. And as I may have mentioned, is now running the Federalist Society, that particular 13-year-old. So a sequential game is one category of games. There are even games where you don't know what move you've made. As I mentioned before, if you try to treat bridge as a game theory problem, as a formal game, bridge is a two-player game with selective amnesia. Because each partnership is really a player, because the two partners have interests entirely in common. When I'm playing, I know what's in my hand, but I don't know what's in my partner's hand. When he's playing, he knows what's in his hand, but not mine. So I've got this sort of weird game where it's as if your mind was forgetting half its information every other move, and then remembering as it came back again. But anyway, so another way you can do it, and a very general way, which doesn't depend on sequential games, is a strategy matrix where you lay out all of my strategies here, all of your strategies here. Each cell shows what happens if I play this strategy, you play that strategy. And so you want to represent a game, but you also want to figure out what a solution means, because the more you look at game theory, the less clear it becomes what a solution really is, because what's the best way for me to play? Well, that depends what you're doing. What's the best way for you to play? That depends on what I'm doing. So you need some kind of a concept. And among the solution concepts we've looked at, one of them is subgame perfect equilibrium. And that's the one that looks a lot like decision theory with two players, where you look at the last choice anybody makes and you say, given his objectives, what choice would he make? If you look at that last step as a decision theory problem, decision theory tells you what you do. So last step, he can do this or that. This one pays him $10. This one pays him $5. Fine, he's going to do this and get $10. Cut off this branch. But of course, his doing this doesn't just give him $10. It also affects what I do, because it's the final outcome of the game we're both involved in. So in my deciding whether I want to ever get him to making that choice, which might depend on my previous choices, I say, well, I know he's going to take the $10 branch. Is that a good one or bad one for me? All right? Does that make sense? So in subgame perfect equilibrium, you're in effect drawing out what looks like a decision diagram with, like, you know, blue squares for you and red squares for the other guy or something like that. You're going to the right-hand side of it. It's the last choice anybody makes. And you're saying, all right, when he gets here, along each of the paths he could take, when he gets to his last choice, what does he do? Fine, we know he's going to do that. Forget about the other alternatives he could do. Given that he's going to do that, choice before that that the other guy makes, knowing what you're going to do, what do I do? And you just unravel the thing all the way back and figure out what will happen, and that tells you what your first decision is.
Can you use that graph to show us what you're saying right now?
I think I've got it on another slide. If I don't, I will.
Okay.
All right. Another concept, a really easy one, except that hardly ever happens, is dominance. And dominance is the case where whatever he's doing, this is the right thing for me to do. All right, and that's really nice. And Prisoner's Dilemma is the famous example of a perverse dominance game, in the sense there's a dominant solution and both players are worse off as a result. but each player correctly says, if he's doing that, I should do this. If he's doing that, I should also do this. And so I do this, and he does the equivalent, and we both confess, and we both get spent 5 years in jail. And von Neumann solution is a sort of a more complicated idea. That's a two-player fixed-sum game, a game where anything that helps me hurts you, so there's no cooperation possibilities, no threats and such. And von Neumann has a solution concept for that. Nash equilibrium, I think I've got them in more detail, so I'm going to stop explaining these at this point. But these are sort of four different ways you might say this is a sense in which a game can be solved. See if I'm right. Yeah, subgame perfect equilibrium. Here, I'm not actually. I don't diagram it, but I explain it. So that in,
let me suppose that this is some different game, and this time that's Bill, and that's Anne, and that's Bill. All right. So ancestors. And each of these final things has two things. It has a payoff plus 100 for, who did I say this was? I think this is Anne, so this is Bill. Let's make life easy. And this is Anne. So this one is plus 100 for Bill, minus 60 for Anne. And similarly, each of these dots has got a payoff for both players. So Anne says, I wonder which thing I should do. Well, she says, if we get to here, if Bill makes this choice, he's going to choose the alternative that gives him a bigger payoff. And it so happens that this alternative is plus 40 for Bill, and this is plus 20 for Bill. So I say, well, I know what Bill's going to do. He is going to prefer 40 to 20 like any sensible person would. And it so happens that this one is also minus 30 for Anne. So I say, if I choose to go down this route, obviously this random thing is going to come in as well, but forgetting about that, we're going to end up there. All right? Or the equivalent up there if the die roll was the other way. All right? Because the circle is still a random thing. Neither is it. How about this? Well, that one was minus 100, plus 100, minus 60. This one, here I'm going to make life easier by removing a random link that I had over there before. Let's suppose this just is a straight 4. And this one is minus 10 plus 200. Now, that's sort of interesting. What does that tell me? It tells me if he gets to here, he's going to take that damage. So that tells me, again, forgetting about the stuff up there, if I go up here, I'm going to lose 30. If I go here, I'm going to lose 10. Therefore, I can go here. All right? That's the basic guts of some game room equation. Very simple, straightforward, one of the, in a sense, simplest things in game theory. All you do is you write your tree, you start at the right-hand side, and you say, last choice somebody makes, what does he do? Now we know what he's going to do, so we can forget about every other branch that comes out of that decision, just only from the ones he chooses. Once we've done that, next decision to the left, do the same thing, end up at the first decision you make and saying which gets me the higher return. And of course, if there are probabilistic things, I'm again going to have to do the same game of saying, well, this has got a 40% chance of getting this result and a 60% chance of getting this result, so the average result is such and such. Do I like that? But it is, however, worth knowing, remembering that this doesn't work if people can do commitment strategies. A commitment strategy is the case where, I don't know if I've got any good ones available here, but where Bill says to himself, well, he doesn't need a human strategy, because this one he actually likes what's going to happen, he's going to get 200. But you could imagine a case where, following out this logic, she makes a choice which isn't very good for Bill. And Bill says, why is she doing that? Because she knows which choice I'm going to make. But if I can set it up so that if she makes the choice that's not good for me, I'm committed to making a choice that's terrible for her, bad for me too, but also terrible for her, then she won't do it, we'll go down the other track and I'll be better off. All right? That's the idea.
Does that make sense, or do I have to... Yeah. People don't want me to do some more stuff on the board because I'd have to invent one. All right, so
if you're thinking about this as a way of thinking about real-world problems, the kind of real-world problem where commitment strategies are irrelevant, where you say we're only in this interaction once, fairly substantial amounts are at stake, and you know however much people may bluster, when it really comes down to it, you're going to make it. The final choice that benefits you, not the final choice you've threatened to make in order to get me to do something else. In those situations, this makes sense. In other situations where people say, I want to get you to do this, and I'll do it by making sure I can't give in to you, and you can think of lots of those cases. With a little effort, you could think of some sort of terrorism scenario where the terrorist says, you know, you're going to jump out of the airplane with a parachute and then I'll take the airplane loaded with the atomic bombs and take it off to Cuba or something or wherever, some place that will pay me for my atomic bombs. And the crew says, I'm sorry, but We aren't going to jump out, and when all of us charge you, you know, either the plane's going to crash or we're going to recapture the airplane, and the terrorist says, look, you guys know how to use parachutes, jumping out the parachute, you'll almost certainly survive, charging me half, you will die, and we say, well, that's a good argument, but as a matter of fact, while you were having this conversation, my buddy was dumping the parachutes, was flushing the parachutes down the toilet, like they wouldn't dip, dumping them out of some space, we don't have any parachutes anymore, therefore, if you don't surrender, we're going to have to rush you, and if we rush you, you're going to lose, so please surrender to us. All right, that's, take a little effort to make it into a movie, but the basic point is that there are cases where reducing your options makes you better off, because you're reducing your options mean that you're going to have to act in a way which hurts you, but hurts him more if he does something so he doesn't do something. Yes?
Cortez burning his ships.
Yeah, that's right. That would be... famous example would be Cortez burning his ships in order that his people couldn't retreat. Though actually, in a sense, that's in a way cutting their options, not just his options. But
he wasn't worried about that. Yeah. He was worried about everybody going, let's go back to Hispaniola and not forget about Mexico.
But you know, the famous example, of course, though it's not really strategic behavior, is Odysseus tying himself to the mast.
What did Odysseus do?
Odysseus, the sirens sang so beautifully that sailors who heard them leaped off their ships and drowned, tried to get to the sirens. So Odysseus has to go past where the sirens are in his ship. And so he says, all right, we'll put wax in the ears of all my sailors so they won't hear the singing so we can get by. But me, I'm a hero. And I want to have heard the music of the sirens, but I don't want to die. So I won't put wax in my ears, but I'll have my sailors tie me to the mast of my ship so I can't get away. And so he does that, and if I remember being a hero, he's in the process of breaking the ropes that are tying him when they get far enough from the sirens so that he can no longer hear them, and therefore he doesn't drown after all. But that sort of tying yourself to the mast is the famous metaphor for a commitment strategy. All right? So it's not exactly the same case, but it's at least a related. Right? Why is this machine not doing anything? Machine has just decided that it is taking a break. That machine has been unfairly exploited for too long. Ah, there we are.
Sounds like the labor workers down at Bon Appetit.
It could be, but yes. So my example of commitment strategy from the case we've discussed before is I will too throw a temper tantrum. That's the kid who says, yes, Daddy, I realize being, you know, having been properly educated in game theory at age 4, I realize that throwing a tantrum won't help me this time, that it'll just result in your being even more severe than if I don't, but after a while, even Daddy's going to get the point that when he puts me to bed when I want to stay up and enjoy the party, I throw a tantrum, and then he will realize he's better off not putting me to bed. All right, that's the commitment strategy. And if you think about a case where commitment is quite important. If you think about a general bilateral monopoly, the game that economists call bilateral monopoly, we call that because we're imagining that there is something which I'm the only seller and you're the only buyer. And monopoly seller is a monopoly, a monopoly buyer is called a monopsony. If you've got both of them happening at once, we call it a two-sided monopoly, bilateral monopoly. And what's happening there, this thing I've got is worth nothing to me and a dollar to you. Any price between zero and a dollar, we both gain, but where the price is going to decide how the gain is divided, so we disagree a little bit on whether I should sell it to you for a penny or for 99 cents. We don't disagree. We both agree I shouldn't keep it because it's worth nothing to me and a dollar to you. We both.
If it's worth nothing to you, why would you even sell it to someone who's worth nothing
to you? Oh, no, it's worth nothing to me, the guy who owns it.
Oh.
It's worth a dollar to the other guy. So we both agree that I ought to sell it to you. It's just I want to sell it to you at the highest possible price, and you want me to sell it to you at the lowest possible price.
Right.
And we're going to end up somewhere in between. And there are lots, that's sort of the normal bargain. You're buying a house. All right, well, you're buying a house. You are actually willing to pay $500,000 for it. Might be the seller's willing to accept $400,000 or even less. You don't really know. But you'd like to get the final price as close to his lowest price as you can. He'd like to get it as close to your highest price as he can. And the simplest case is the one where you actually know people's lowest and highest prices. But even that isn't simple because of commitment strategies. Because I may say, yes, indeed, that house is worth $500,000 to you. But here is the contract I just signed by which I agreed to buy my second choice house if I couldn't get this house for $450,000. And having signed that contract, now it's not worth $500,000 because now I'd end up with two houses and I only need one house. So that would be a commitment strategy. That would be a case in which in some way I've changed how it's in my interest to act, and since you'd rather sell it to me at $450,000 than not sell it at all, I end up getting a house for $450,000. So that's a very common situation, and as you see it, union management bargaining is sort of the classic case of that, haggling over the price of something like a house. But if you think of a lot of international transactions, one possible interpretation of what's happening with Iran, though I think probably not the right interpretation, is that the Iranians are willing to not make nuclear weapons, but they would like to be paid as high a price as possible to not make nuclear weapons in terms of economic aid or whoever, I don't know what they want, but something else. So that's one possibility in diplomatic bargaining, that in fact both sides agree that one side should give in at a certain point, and the bargaining is about how high a price they pay to do so. Now, other cases, of course, an alternative reading of what's happening with Iran is they have no interest at all in giving in, that they perfectly naturally, I mean, I can see it from their standpoint, and, you know, we got atomic bombs. The Israelis, although they don't admit it, everybody knows, have nuclear weapons.
They have the most
problem. What?
No.
That is the classic line on Israel, I don't know if anybody uses it anymore, is that the Israelis said they would not be the first people to introduce nuclear weapons to the Middle East. And what they meant by that was we haven't tightened the last screw. But in any case, all these, from the Iranian standpoint, I don't know if they're better off with nuclear weapons, but I can easily see that they would think they are, and they would say other countries have them, including countries that don't like us very much. So what we're actually doing is pretending to bargain in order to draw out as long as possible other people's attempts to get us to stop while we keep doing it. And then some nice day we'll say, ha ha, fooled you, bang, we just had a test explosion somewhere. All right, that's another problem. I don't know which they're actually doing, but those are both possible. So my point is only that some diplomacy really is straightforward bilateral monopoly bargaining. And the fundamental two strategies, I think, in trying to get better terms in these bargainings, one of them is a commitment strategy to somehow change the situation so that you really won't accept certain offers, and thus the other person will make you better offers. And the other is to mislead the other person. If I say to my wife when no one else is around, boy, that's a gorgeous house. If we have to pay $500,000, we pay $500,000. And she says, yeah, I know, but keep your voice down. And then when we see that the seller of the house is in the room, we start talking a little bit more loudly about how nice the other house we've been looking at is. and how, you know, we can get this one at a good price. This one's probably a little better, but the other one's got more room, and it did have more room as it happened. It just wasn't nearly as pretty a house. And they're asking less money, so we're not quite sure. So you could imagine trying to fool the other party about where your bargaining limits are, or you could imagine commitment shredders to actually change where they are. And, of course, both ways have the same risk, that maybe we really persuade them we're not willing to go over 450, and what we don't realize is that they aren't willing to go below 460 for some reason. And we think they're just bluffing, so that we don't get the house. We end up with our second best house, and we're not as happy as we actually were with the house we got. Beautiful house. 100 years old. More than 100 years old now. So anyway, so that's the risk. The risk is that if you're too clever in this, the transaction doesn't go through and you're both worse off as a result. Strategy matrix. That was the one that got everybody unhappy when we applied it on the midterm. And the strategy matrix. Each strategy is a full description of what I will do. So each strategy says, I'll make this move. If you do that, I'll do this. If you do that, I'll do this. Complete description. At that stage, once I've done that, you might, if the die rolls one, I'll do this. At each stage, depending on either random events or your choices, here is a full list of what I'll do. So you could imagine that if I write down my strategy and you write down your strategy, we now go home and he reads our two strategies and plays out the whole game. All right, because all he has to do is say, well, he starts by moving his point here. Looking at his paper, what does he say he does if the first move is that? He does this. And looking at his strategy, what does he say if that guy's response is this? He does this. Whole game plays out, and we're off, you know, getting drunk or something. We don't have to be there anymore. So that's the idea. And actually writing out such matrices, except for very simple games, is impossible because the number of strategies is so huge. But mathematicians don't have to worry about it. They're proving theorems about things, and so you don't have to actually give the list. You just say, all right, let there be N strategies for one party and M strategies for the other party with the following characteristics and prove your theorem, which is what von Neumann did, in effect. So the matrix shows all the strategies, and for each strategy, the cell where the column and the row intersect shows what happens. And we looked at a strategy matrix for scissors, paper, stone. All right, that's really simple strategy. You only got only one move game, one move simultaneous game, so it's not exactly rocket science. On that one, scissors, paper, stone, scissors, paper, stone, 0, 0, 0. If you do the same thing, nothing happens. And I can never remember which one goes first, but let's assume that the left goes first. In that case, this one is -1, +1, assuming that's the payoff for winning the game, because scissors cuts paper. So if he does paper, he does scissors, this guy loses one, and this guy gains one. Right? This one would be +1, -1, and you can fill in the rest of the points the same. Right? So that's a case where there are only three strategies, so life is really easy. But there are 6 billion strategies, and it's a little bit harder to fit. So do people understand conceptually what a strategy matrix is now? Just shows all of the ways each player could have decided to play and the outcome from any way I decided to play and any way you decided to play. And so that's an easy case.
Does the second player always have more choices?
No, of course not. We're considering all possible games. You could have a game where the second player had, where I have 100 choices and you've got 2 choices, right? You know, my 100 choices are, do I offer you $1, $2, $3, et cetera, for the thing you're selling, and your choice is accept or refuse. That would be a very, very simple matrix. That would be a possible matrix. Right? And what von Neumann showed was that if you limit yourself to 2-person fixed sum games, games where there are 2 players and where anything I win, you lose, like that one. But that wasn't true of bilateral monopoly. Bilateral monopoly, if the contract falls through, neither of us gets anything. Whereas if I sell you the apple for 50 cents, each of us gets a 50 cent gain. I get 50 cents in money and you get a dollar apple for 50 cents. So that's not a fixed sum game. That's a game where some outcomes are better for both of us and some worse for both of us. So non-unionism, we only consider fixed sum games where we're completely opponents. In those games, there is always a pair of strategies that can be found, each of which is the best strategy against the other, and where for each of them, there is no strategy that will make that one produce a worse outcome than against the other. So if I play my best strategy and you play your best strategy, I lose a dollar and you gain a dollar. It's an asymmetric game where you've got the advantage, it happens. If you play any other strategy at all against me, I can't lose more than a dollar. So in that sense, mine is the best one. And if you play your strategy, there's no strategy that I can play that will hold you to lose it, that will make you win less than a dollar. So in some sense, my best strategy, your best strategy against each other. That's the von Neumann solution. And then dominant strategies, the easier case is the one where whatever you do, this is the right thing for me to do. Whatever I do, that's the right thing for you to do. Notice that isn't true with von Neumann solution, because it might be that even though there's nothing you can do that will result in my doing worse than a dollar, there might be some really stupid things you can do where I'll still lose a dollar if I play my optimal strategy. But if I knew you were going to do something stupid, there's a strategy which is really bad against good players, but is great for stealing candy from babies. All right? That's the difference. The dominant strategy is where whatever you do, this is the right thing. Whereas the von Neumann one, this is the right thing if you're doing the right thing, and yours is the right thing if I'm doing the right thing, as it were.
Is pronounced Neumann?
Von Neumann, yes.
Von Neumann?
Yes. Johnny von Neumann.
That, the von Neumann solution is the most challenging conceptually to,
yes.
To actually
yes.
accept,
yes.
I guess. And I'm not sure if it's recognized in all game theory courses, or...
Oh, sure. Von Neumann invented game theory. He is the biggest name in the subject, in the field. He literally wrote the book, Von Neumann and Morgenstern, Theory of Games and Economic Behavior. And this is, I think, chapter 2.
Von Neumann is more about the big strategy?
Von Neumann did a whole bunch of stuff. It's just that that's the last point at which he really got an answer. Yeah, one, in order to do this, he has mixed strategies. That in order to prove this result, some of the strategies you have to use are going to have to take the form, flip a coin.
That's so challenging, just because of the mixed strategy.
Yep. But
the mix changes
yes,
every second.
Yeah. But von Neumann spends a whole book trying to solve game theory. What he's really trying to do is to find a complete general solution to all games.
Right.
And no one's done it since. And that's partly because he was one of the smartest people of the 20th century, by all accounts I can see. I think I've told you a couple of my von Neumann stories that Enrico Fermi, very famous physicist, after meeting von Neumann, he turns to one of his colleagues and he says, "You know, that man is cleverer than I am, just as I'm cleverer than you are." And not afflicted by undue modesty, but, you know, he's an honest guy. But von Neumann does a bunch of things, but this, at least in my view, is the last point at which he really answers a question, as it were, as opposed to trying more and more desperately to find answers to questions in very ingenious and interesting ways. And as a prisoner's dilemma, for everybody who remembers prisoner's dilemma, both sides confessing is the dominant strategy, the outcome, two dominant strategies. For a many-player game, a very common and useful concept is Nash equilibrium, invented by Cournot, but generalized by Nash. And what is that? Each of us is picking a strategy. We're all playing against each other. We're all interacting with each other. Against is too strong. Some of us might be allies. And given the strategies all of you have picked, I've got the right one for me. Given the strategies all of us have picked, you've got the right one for you. That's true for everybody. That's the equilibrium. Equilibrium is a set of strategies such that each person is doing the right thing for his objectives, given what everybody else is doing. It doesn't have to be unique. For example, if everybody's driving on the right-hand side of the road, by God, they're all right. Anyone who drove on the left side of the road would have bad things happen. If everybody's driving on the left side of the road, they're all correct also. All right? So... I suggest, by the way, that when you were discussing traffic directions, that you use the word correct rather than the word right when it is appropriate, because it avoids a certain amount of confusion. And So a Nash equilibrium doesn't have to be unique, and it doesn't have to be optimal. You might have a case where if all of us shifted our strategies, we'd all be better off. But given what you are doing, nothing I can do that makes you better off and the same for everybody else. And that was the case that I have of the prisoners escaping from death row, and there is the governor-to-be of California, who's a prison guard in this scenario, and he's got one bullet in his gun, and he points it at the prisoners and says, all right, who's the one who wants to die with me? First guy across that line, I'm going to kill him. Second guy? Well, I'll be dead by then. Not much longer after that, but I'm going to kill the first guy because I'm a man. And each prisoner correctly looks around and he says, well, how about you, you rush him? How about you rush him? Me rush him? If I rush him, I die. If I don't rush him, maybe the appeal will go through. Right. And so, or maybe my birthday cake will have a saw in it or something. So that's a case where all the prisoners would be better off on average if they all rushed the guard, because only one of them gets shot. And yet each of them is better off not rushing. So that's, from the standpoint of the prisoners, a perverse Nash equilibrium, a Nash equilibrium which gives them a worse result than they could get by something else that wouldn't be a Nash equilibrium. Because if everybody is rushing it, that's not a Nash equilibrium, because if all you guys are rushing it, what's it in my interest to do?
To sit back and watch
who wins. I know who's going to win. Sit back and see who gets killed, and then go there after that. Right. So from that standpoint, as I say, so you don't want to think of it as an optimum or as unique, but it is a possible stable situation. And one problem, which I've discussed at some length earlier, is that there's a certain amount of ambiguity, because what I'm saying, my strategy, when I'm choosing a strategy, well, do I do this, or do I do that, or I do that. And I'm assuming that you people all keep the same strategy whatever I do. But of course, what I do may affect what the alternatives are available to you. So there's a certain sense in which you can't do the same thing when I change what I do. And somewhere buried in your Nash equilibrium definition has got to be some definition of a strategy which says you're doing the same thing means X. And the example that I discuss is we're a bunch of firms in the same industry. The Nash equilibrium, the hypothetical Nash equilibrium, is a list of how many goods each of us is producing and what price we sell them for. If I chose to change it by producing some more goods, the rest of you couldn't keep on selling the same amount at the same price, because nobody would buy some of it, because I've now gotten some of the market that you didn't. So therefore, in order to define an Nash equilibrium, we would have to say, is your strategy the decision of what to produce and let price adjust, or is your strategy the decision of what price and let quantity adjust? And those turn out to give different equilibria, so it actually matters. We then had, for no reason I could detect, the book chose to put insurance in with game theory. We looked at the two sort of standard insurance problems, one of which is called moral hazard and one adverse selection. And moral hazard, which is a problem which under different names keeps recurring through the course and throughout economics, is I'm taking an action, someone else bears part of the cost of that action, I don't take account of that part of the cost, so I might take the wrong action. And the whole argument for policies to control global warming, from an economist standpoint, that's all like a moral hazard argument. That's all an externality argument. The argument says, if there's only one person on Earth, he's going to worry about global warming. We don't need any rules, though, because he's going to say to himself, all right, produce too much CO2, it's going to get hot around here, so I decide what my trade-offs are. If there are 8 billion people on Earth, each person says, I produce some more CO2, temperature of the world goes up a millionth of a degree. And not only who cares, but insofar as it does any damage, I'm sharing that damage with 8 billion other people. I'm not getting very much of it. So that's a case where each person rationally, correctly, with no problems of ignorance, will say, no reason I should restrict my company. And nonetheless, it might be the case, I don't know if we should do anything about it or not, but it might be the case we'd all be better off if we made rules limiting all of us. And that's so the moral hazard is the particular case in insurance. I insure my factory, now I stop spending money on sprinkler systems and guards to make sure that nobody comes in at night and that I don't have a tramp smoking in it or something, and whatever things that might burn it down, because if it burns down, that's the insurance company's problem. And that's, from an economist standpoint, is inefficient because some of the precautions I don't take are precautions that save us $10,000 would cost me $20. Clearly, they're worth taking. But since all of that savings is to the insurance company and I'm the one taking them, why should I bother? Right? That's the moral hazard problem. And if I only have the factory insured for half its value, then many of those precautions I still take, but the ones which do $1,000 worth of good and cost $700, I don't take, so I'm only getting $500 or $1,000 savings if half the loss goes to the insurance company. All right? So, makes sense. That's the moral hazard problem. That's the externality problem more generally. And two of the possible solutions, one of them is that the insurance company says, since we observe this problem, we're going to write the rules on what precautions you have to make, and that's a condition of our agreeing to insure you, got to put in sprinklers and so forth and so on. And the other partial alternative is they say, we'll insure you, but not for 100%. We'll insure you for 50%, because that means that at least the important precautions will all get taken, even though there'll be a few places where you could have done better if you were bearing the whole loss. Questions? No. All right. So then the other standard insurance problem is what's called adverse selection. And adverse selection comes with what's called asymmetric information, a situation where we've got information about the goods. One of the two parties has it, the other one doesn't, and the one who has it can't provably transmit it. Yes?
Is asymmetric information separate, distinct, or similar to imperfect information?
It is a particular form of imperfect
information. During a transaction?
It's a particular form of imperfect information. If you had a case where neither of us knew which cars were lemons and which ones were cream puffs, that would be imperfect information, but it wouldn't give you any adverse selection. You'd be selling me a gamble, I'd be buying a gamble.
That's market.
All of these things happen in markets. They just lead to different problems, right? And you don't get adverse selection there. In that case, what happens is sometimes you discover you've paid too much and sometimes you discover you've paid too little and, you know, you win some, you lose others. But adverse selection, what happens is that after you work through the logic of it, you say, the fact that when I make an offer you're willing to sell it probably means it's a lemon. So I better make you a lemon offer. And you make me a lemon offer. And if I'm selling a lemon, I sell it. And that's fine. We've gotten a lemon sold at a cheap price. But if I've got a cream puff, I say, you think I'm going to sell this lovely car, which has never given me a minute's worry, for that piddling price you're offering? No. And so even though the value of the cream puff is more to you than to me, it doesn't sell. Because I've got no way of proving to you it's a cream puff. And since I can't prove it, you won't offer me a cream puff price. And since I know it's a cream puff, I won't accept your low price. That's adverse selection. So one solution is a guarantee. I say the way I'm going to prove to you that this is a cream puff is we've got this mechanic here. Both of us know he's a reliable mechanic. I have told him that for the first year, you bring the car in with any problem, I'll pay to have it fixed. That's one possible solution. You might argue that one reason why cars come with warranties is that the manufacturer is using that as a way of telling you this is really a good car, because if it really were a lemon, we couldn't afford to give you that warranty because it would cost us too much. And another possibility is that you could somehow arrange things so that neither party had the information. And that's my genetic testing story. If you buy your insurance at a point when the buyer hasn't been tested and the insurance company doesn't know if you've been tested, then you're buying and selling a gamble when you get life insurance or health insurance, but that's true for both of you, so there's no adverse selection problem. Or, of course, you can get both parties informed. If there's a reliable mechanic who can tell me believably whether it's a cream puff or not, then the problem goes away. But it's the case where one of us has the information, the other doesn't, and the guy who has it can't prove it to the one who doesn't. All right, we're just not running out of time. The next one is going to be contracting. So I will finish going through this list Tuesday. And again, I suggest that you should be looking through stuff and trying to figure out what things you'd like to discuss that you don't understand. I will go.